It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Passion Richardson is with us today. She's a member of the University of Kentucky Athletics Hall of Fame. She was a bronze medalist at the 2000 Sydney Olympics as she ran the anchor leg on the United States 4x100-meter relay team in the opening round and the semifinals in that event, and also the silver medalist in the 60-meter dash at the 1997 USA Indoor Championships. And while at UK, she was a four-time All-American in the 55 meters, 100 meters, and 4x100-meter relay. She set UK records in the 60 meters, 100 meters, and was part of the school record 4x100-meter relay team. Was SEC bronze medalist at 100 meters in 1997. She was on the World University Games gold medal 4x100-meter relay team in 97 and took the silver medal in the same event at the Pan American Games that same year. She later served as an assistant coach for UK track and field and is currently an academic counselor for UK athletics. Passion, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, before we
How
get
are you
in,
doing today?
Oh, doing well, and hope you are. I was going to ask you about your time now at UK, your current activities. Before we get into your background and career as an athlete, your academic counselor, I believe, to men's and women's track and men's tennis, and of course, everyone has had to make adjustments due to the COVID-19 pandemic. How has that affected your work as an academic counselor?
Well, most definitely, it has had some impact on how we interact with our students. Of course, everybody is Zooming, you know, all day, every day now. And so for me, I love interacting with my kids. And so they come in the office a lot and we get to laugh and we get to talk and we get to interact a lot. But unfortunately, given the circumstances that we're dealing with right now, I don't have the opportunity to do that in-person interaction. But I do still have conversations, you know, quite frequently with the kids. But I most definitely miss the physical interaction with the kids on a day-to-day basis. And especially with the, you know, you've already built that relationship with the returning students. Unfortunately, with the incoming freshmen or transfer students that we have on the team, you know, we haven't necessarily had the opportunity to build those relationships and to build those bonds like I have with the continuing students. So it most definitely has impacted how I interact with them. And then also to a certain degree, you just don't know where to draw the line. It's almost like, you know, you're working 24/7 whenever you're at home. And so that most definitely has had some serious impact on, you know, when that work day actually ends.
Yeah, it's been quite an adjustment for everyone. And, of course, a lot of the young people, especially, as you say, first-year students, it's a whole new experience for them to begin with. And now to have this communication affected so radically by the pandemic, it's a challenge for everybody, and everybody's trying to adjust as best they can, as you say. I wanted to ask you about your first interest in track or your first interest in running. I'm picturing a competition among kids at schools and at home, always racing each other. Is that the way you got started, that you discovered that you had some exceptional speed? Were you competitive as a child?
Absolutely. You know, in the neighborhood, you know, growing up in the neighborhood with the neighborhood kids, we were always racing. We were always competing at something. So no matter what it was. And so, which we knew from a very young age that I had some speed and had some talent, but, you know, never knew that it would one day develop into what it developed into. But actually how I started running track, I'd actually participated, you know, at the end of the school year. Every year you have field day. And so I remember we had to run 300 yards. And it was all of the girls and all of the boys running at the same time. So, and I won out of all of the girls and all the boys. And at the time, my dad was in the military. And so we were actually stationed at Fort Campbell. So I was there on the military base there. And I remember my physical education teacher asking my father if he could enter me in the AAU track meet that was coming up. And that was in Owensboro. And so that's actually where I ran my first track meet. And then we get there and I was the only one in my age group. I was 10 years old. There was no other kids in my age group there. And so I told my father, I was like, well, I'm not going to run. And he was like, yes, you are. We drove all this way. You're going to run. And so I ended up having to run against the 13-year-olds. And so which was two levels up from my age group.
Mm-hmm.
And so ran the 100 and ran the 200 and won both of them. And so that was actually the start of my track and field career. So, and ran until up until the time that I retired in 2001. So that's how that all got started.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there was a point when you realized that you had a chance to do something special. And I guess that was it with your father's encouragement there. You took on people older than you. And for most of us, there's a great deal of difference between trying to compete as a 10-year-old and as a 12 and 13-year-old. There's a lot of growth in there for most people. So the fact that you were able to get a couple of victories there, you must have really gone home with a lot of confidence that day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think from there we went to the regional meet, which was held in Detroit sometime later. And then I wasn't able to go to the nationals because my father had something to do for work. But yeah, I mean, it just kind of grew from there. But and I never really, even to that degree, I didn't really know what I had.
Mm-hmm.
Or that it could, you know, potentially, you know, earn me a scholarship to go to college. And so for me at that point, it was really, I was just running and racing because I was having fun. And then, and then I competed at the ARCO Jesse Owens Games. I don't know if you've ever heard of that event, but they no longer have the event, but they have eight teams and it's from different regions in the country. But at the time I was in sixth grade and living in Alaska at the time, and I'd actually made the North Alaskan team and had an opportunity to come to go to LA to race against the seven other regions. And so that was like really my first really, really big experience, you know, and running on a national level. So, and then just from there, you know, in high school, you know, freshman year started receiving letters of interest from schools and programs and stuff. And it went from there, but never really understanding, okay, I can go to college on a scholarship. And then when I understood that, but also I just wanted to go to college. So for me, it was really a means to an end, but also at the same time had the opportunity, you know, to run and to continue to do what I love to do.
Now, you went to high school in Ohio, right? Berea, Ohio, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Freshman year in Alaska at Lathrop High School in Alaska, uh-huh, in Fairbanks. And then from 10th grade until graduation, I went to Berea High School in Ohio, yes.
And you mentioned having experience there at Fort Campbell as well, I guess, with your father's military career. Going away somewhat to college was no big deal. You'd already seen a good portion of the country by that time and lived in several different places, it sounds like.
Exactly. You know, that most definitely, I think, it helped with me and my brother, you know, with our growth and, you know, being away from home. It, like you said, it wasn't anything new to us. And so we were used to, you know, living in different places, living around different people. And so going off to college, most definitely, it was just another trip, another move for us, because we moved almost every 3 to 4 years anyway. So that was just another move for us.
What did go into your decision then to come to the University of Kentucky?
You know, when I came to my visit here, an interesting story behind that. When I was being recruited, I'd actually gone to Fort Campbell, and this is when we were in Ohio. I had gone to Fort Campbell to go stay with my aunt. My uncle was actually stationed at Fort Campbell as well, and he was away teaching at West Point. And my aunt was pregnant at the time, and so I told my uncle that I would go and stay with her while he was away for the next 3 weeks. And so a friend of mine, we went, stay with my aunt, and we met some guys in the outside in the neighborhood, and they were telling us that they had a classmate that was going to the University of Kentucky on a track scholarship and that she was a sprinter. And so of course at that point, the only thing I knew about UK track and field was that they really didn't have a sprint program, that they were better known for the distance. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and I started laughing, and I was like, Kentucky doesn't have any sprinters? And so I get back home, and as soon as I get back home, my dad hands me all these letters, and he was like, the coach for the University of Kentucky has been calling you. And I just started laughing. And I was like, you know what? You never say what you will or what you won't do. And so he ended up coming to our house to sit down and visit with me and my family, and then came on my recruiting visit. And I was supposed to go and visit another school after I left here, like 2 weeks later. But I knew when I was here, I knew Kentucky is where I wanted to be. They were in the process of building the Sprint program, and I wanted to be a part of something bigger than, you know, just going to a program, and they had already established themselves in the history of having successful programs. I wanted to be a part of something bigger. And so the coach, he was very personable. I knew that he cared about me as a person, and I think that that's so important, because whenever student athletes, whenever they're making these decisions as to which college they're going to go to, a lot of that decision is based largely on the coach in that relationship. And so I was comfortable with that. And so I knew that once I, even before I left, I knew that I was coming back to UK. And I actually ended up going on another visit before I signed. And I went and I hated it. And so as soon as I got off the plane, my dad picked me up from the airport and I was like, where's the letter of intent from UK? And I signed it, called the coach and said, I'm coming to UK. Mm-hmm. But I knew in my heart of hearts before I left the campus that I was coming back.
Now, you're speaking of coach, the head coach, Don Weber at that time. Is that correct?
Yes, Don Weber was my head coach, mm-hmm. and Daryl Anderson was my event-specific coach, yes.
Okay. I was going to ask you about relationships with coaches in a sport like track. You have individual events, and you have a team concept, and, of course, they're trying to develop, as you said there, a sprint program at that time. What's the key to a track athlete, especially a sprinter, having a good relationship with a coach? What do you think made your relationship with him such a good one?
Well, I think more than anything, he cared about me as a person. Mm-hmm. And so I think you have to – I tell my students all the time, and I tell people all the time, I don't care what someone knows, but until you know that they care about you as an individual and your well-being overall, then they will run through a brick wall for you. They will do anything in the world for you. So I think that that is important. I have a very strong relationship with my parents. And so for me as a kid – really going away for the first time and spending an extended period of time away from my family, you know, that was important to me to have that family relationship and to know that when I walked away from my parents, that they were going to take care of me. And so and you have to understand your students. You have to know them on a personal level in order for you to understand what motivates them. It is key that you understand them from a personal standpoint. So I think that's vital in what you get out of them, because you never know what a person is going through. They could be going through all kinds of stuff, but whenever they walk on the track, then you may not know that they're going through certain things in their life. And so I think just understanding them from a much personal level, I think that most definitely is key to having success with those student athletes.
Well, you had an outstanding career at UK, four-time All-American. Now, by the time you got to college, of course, you'd received a lot of attention from various schools as you completed high school. So I'm sure you had some high expectations, but were you expecting that kind of success to become prominent nationally as you did, or were you hopeful that you could?
Well, you know, I'm just a competitor, and so my goal was always – you know, to do my best anytime I stepped on the track. I've always had high expectations for myself. So, yes, I always expected to do well whenever I came to college. You know, even though I know that I was going to be facing a lot stiffer competition and especially competing in the SEC, it doesn't get any more competitive than that. And so, but I was never going to lower myself or to think that I couldn't compete, you know, at this level. You know, I say all the time that you can beat someone on paper all day long, but it's all about who shows up at the track, who's lining up on the line that day for competition. I could be having my best day today, whereas I may have been competing against someone who has beat me in the past, but it's all about who shows up that day, who's better prepared, and who has the will on that given day.
as the Olympics came up in 2000. Tell us a little bit about the process there in track and field as far as who actually is representing the USA in Olympics, how that worked for you leading up to the Sydney Olympics. In other words, determining just spots on the team.
Yeah, most definitely. So first and foremost, they take the top 32 qualifying times to the Olympic trials, and it really all it just depends on the specific event. But usually in the lane events, like the 100, 200, it's 32. They take 32 competitors, and so and throughout that process, you have the quarterfinals, the semifinals, and then the finals, and then and of course advancing from those rounds. And in the finals of the race, generally what the top three finishers will be the they will be the primary runners and run individually and compete individually in those events at the Olympics. And then they take the remaining competitors from that final race to make up the relay pool. So that's how the team is chosen for the 100 meters and the 400 meters mm-hmm. to make up the 4x1 and the 4x4 relays.
Now, when you get the final news that you will be part of the U.S. Olympic team, what was the feeling like? Does it happen in just one moment where you know that it's you, or how did that happen, and what were your feelings at the time?
Well, yes, you knew at the moment because you already knew that they were going to be taking all eight finalists from the 100 to make up the relay pool. So, yes, I knew in that moment. And so for me, you know, it's hard to describe, you know, what that moment felt like because I dreamt about that from the time that I started running track, you know, and having watched the Olympics on television and watching track meets and idolizing, you know, individuals. And so and I said I wanted to do that. I wanted to be in that place, but we know that it is very hard to get to that place. There's a small percentage of people that actually have the opportunity to realize that. And so in that moment, just knowing that I was a part of that very small club, that exclusive club, you know, and I had finally realized a childhood dream, you know, I was more than elated. To know that I had just accomplished, you know, a childhood dream, and I was going to have the opportunity to run and to represent the United States of America. So, but very exciting, very exciting. And at days, you know, even now, even though it's been 20 years since I ran in the Olympics, I think about it at times now, and I still can't believe that I'm an Olympian.
Yeah, now you've had a chance to look back on it. Yeah, congratulations. That must have been just a real thrill, even to someone who's accomplished quite a bit in your sport. I think most people that watch the Olympics, and of course that's millions across the world, are always taken in by the opening ceremonies, something to tune in and see the athletes from all the sports and all the countries. Millions of people watch on television. It looks like just an unforgettable experience for all the athletes. So what do you remember about that?
You know, that is one outside of running. That is one of my most memorable moments of the Olympic Games. Because number one, just getting ready, and all of the athletes were in the Olympic Village, and everyone's all dressed up and in our outfits and ready to head over to the stadium. You know, we're all out there having fun, talking, taking pictures. And then we were in the arena where they had the gymnastics meet, you know, prior to going and walking into the stadium. And so all of the countries, all the teams are in there, all of the different delegations are in there. And so it was amazing, just the spirit, because you had every team is in there chanting, and it was just amazing just to see it back and forth. Even though we're competing against them, you know, we were all there for one purpose and one goal. And so, but walking into the stadium, I would say I was somewhere in the middle of the delegation, and we had over 600 people in the U.S. delegation, and I was somewhere in the middle. And so I couldn't tell where the U.S. delegation, where it started, and I couldn't tell where it ended. But I just remember as we're walking into the stadium, as we're getting closer and closer to the entrance, and you could hear everyone in the stadium chant USA. And I just remember just like my heart just racing and just getting very emotional. And, you know, there was a lot of tears being shed at that time because it's like that moment is finally here. You know, you've waited for that for so long. And to have that opportunity and to hear people from all over the world chanting USA. And so that most definitely would be one of the most memorable moments for me from the games.
We're talking about this 2000 Olympics in Sydney, and you have a bronze medal as the member of the 4x100 relay team for the U.S. But it looked like you might not get that medal or get to keep it after Marion Jones admitted to using banned performance-enhancing drugs. Tell us how that came about and how that got resolved.
Well, I initially had learned about it. So I guess it was like, it was in October of 2007 is when I learned about it. And a friend of mine had called and told me to turn on the television that Marion Jones was on television and had just admitted to using to doping. And so at that moment, I mean, just everything that I had accomplished, it all had just flashed before my eyes. Because, of course, it doesn't matter at that point, you know, who really did what. Now it's going to be tainted. It's going to be tarnished. And the thought of what I had accomplished, the goals, the dreams that I had as a 10-year-old were now going to be tarnished by someone who, you know, was not very thoughtful or very concerned about what would happen to her teammates should she, like she did, admit to doping or be caught for doping. And so that's how I found out. And then the next day when I returned to work, I started receiving all kinds of phone calls and emails, you know, from different media outlets asking about the Marion Jones, about her admitting to doping. And unfortunately, you know, we ended up going through a very long, it's like a 3-year legal process that we ended up going through, you know, to fight to keep our medals. And so, you know, the IOC, IAAF, they had decided at that point that, or IAAF had decided that they were going to strip us of our medal. But for me, that wasn't okay. And so for everything that I had ever worked for, everything that I ever dreamt about, I was not going to allow that to happen without fighting for what I know I worked hard to earn. So.
And you do have the medal today. You were successful in your fight to keep it.
Yes, mm-hmm. we were able to retain our medals. What happened is we ended up suing the USOC, and we actually, and our case was fought in the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And so we had to go through, like I said, we had to go through all those legal fights, all those legal battles. And then the attorney, we had an attorney that was representing us, you know, in that case. And so, and then thankfully we came out the winners on that and was able to retain our medals.
Now, we talked about the opening ceremonies and, of course, winning the medal at the Olympics. Anything else that comes to mind first as far as your memories of the Olympic experience? Anything that really jumps out, maybe a friendship with an athlete from another country or just anything that happened during the entire Olympic period that remains with you today?
Most definitely. And not necessarily with anyone from another country, but most definitely, you know, during that time, my roommate, Hazel Clark, was my roommate. And to this day, we are great friends and we communicate on a regular basis. And she and I really didn't know one another, although she was at the University of Florida competing at the same time I was competing here at UK. And we didn't necessarily run in the same circles. However, she and I ended up being roommates at the Olympics. Actually, we ended up being roommates in Monaco at the Van Damme meet there prior to going to the Olympic Games. And, you know, and more than anything, she's like a sister to me now. You know, I had an opportunity to be in her wedding when she got married. And so I will most definitely cherish that relationship forever. So most definitely, I walked away with a lot of great memories from that experience.
Let me ask you about getting ready for a race. We hear athletes and other sports talk about putting the game face on or having the same routine to get ready for whatever their event is. What was it like for you? Did you have a strict routine that you stuck to that was personal to you as far as getting ready for a race?
I went inside a lot. So I was very standoffish a lot whenever, you know, when I was preparing for my race or even the night before. Like, my parents always knew when I was nervous because I would just start cleaning. So <Yeah. laughs> that was very common. I would just start cleaning. And so, but and then in that morning, you know, it was always oatmeal for me. That was my breakfast. Mm-hmm. And so I never deviated from that. But once I was on the track during my warm-up preparation, I was always very quiet. So most times I would just put my headphones on and I was to myself a lot. My mom used to always tell me, she always told me I looked so mean, and I was like, that's just my game face. Yeah. And so it's not like I was trying to appear that way. It was just I was really focused and really concentrating on what I was doing and what I was getting ready to do, you know, just playing my race over and over and over in my head, you know, the things I needed to work on, the things I needed to do, the things I needed to execute. So everything that I had practiced and had been working on leading up to that. So that was kind of, you know, nothing major, you know, but that pretty much was how I was leading up to my competition.
It sounds like, as you say, you kind of kept within yourself there as far as your own preparation, your mental preparation for a race. But normally, is there much interaction at all? It doesn't seem to be very demonstrative if we watch track and field athletes compete. But is there much interaction between competing athletes as you get ready for a race? Any attempts to get a psychological advantage or to intimidate somebody? Just something that we see sometimes maybe on the basketball floor or the football field. Is there anything that compares with that in track? Or is that what most athletes do, trying to keep to themselves and prepare themselves that way?
You know, and every individual, every person is different in how they prepare. But there were times, I mean, up until it was time for me to start warming up, I interacted quite a bit, you know, with other people. So you find a lot of interaction. You do find a lot of, you know, the mind games. But for the most part, you do get some interaction, but not a great deal. People are off trying to, like you said, mentally prepare for their race. So,
once you become an athlete that of the stature that you reached, there's some international travel involved and traveling cross country to compete and in other countries. Top athlete very often has a chance to see the world and compete in other countries, as you have. What do you think you took away from that experience as far as being able to see the world at such a young age?
Oh, most definitely, because I actually made my first junior team when I was a sophomore in high school, so I was only 16 years old. And even at that point, I was and I wasn't even prepared for that experience. We went to Spain. We competed in Salamanca, Spain. And we were in London and Wales. And actually, in leading up to that, when I made the team, I didn't have a passport. And so everything had to be done really, really quickly. And so my parents were trying to get my passport expedited. And I literally got on the plane and met the team in Spokane, Washington, in preparation to leave to go to London. And literally the day it was time for us to leave to head to London, I still hadn't gotten my passport.
Wow.
And like shortly before that, because they were actually going to have to send me back home. And so in walks the postman, and he had my passport.
Just in time.
So I was just in time. So I was literally going to have to go back home had I not gotten my passport that day. So, but just this thought, you know, as a kid, I traveled a lot anyway, just, you know, because of my father being in the military. And so, but having the opportunity to experience the world, to see the world, you know, you see a lot of these places on television and you never think that you would literally have an opportunity to go and to see these places and to experience the culture. That to me, I think that is one of the greatest things about track and field. So you look at some of the other sports, you know, football, basketball, for the most part, if you're playing in the NBA, you're playing here, you know, here in the United States. But with track and field, you have to travel. And, you know, and people don't celebrate track and field in the United States the way that it's celebrated in Europe. You know, everybody in Europe understands track and field, and they know the athletes. And so we don't, unfortunately, we don't get celebrated that way here in the United States, but unless you're a big name. And so that afforded me so much. And as you stated before, just like, you know, making friends as I went abroad, those relationships, they're so important. And so some of those people still very much a part of my life and my relationship. So I think it afforded me a great deal. And so I tell people all the time, if you ever have the chance to travel and to travel abroad, do it, because it will change your world. It will change your life. It will change your perspective, most definitely, and give you a greater appreciation for what we have here in the United States. And some of, you know, depending on some of the places where I had an opportunity to go.
You mentioned the adventure, I guess it, you can describe it that way, with the passport, the last minute arrival of the passport there. But once you got to do your traveling, any particular adventure, maybe not related to track and field, but some other experience that you had while you were traveling that stands out now, one that when you get together with friends, you want to say, well, let me tell you what happened on this trip. Is there anything that that jumps out at you as far as your travels are concerned on that regard?
That's hilarious, actually, and it was with Hazel. So we were in Monaco, and I remember we were leaving the hotel, and we were just going to go out and go walk around just a little bit, just to do some sightseeing. And as we were walking out, Maurice Green was pulling up. He had rented a car. He had a little BMW convertible that he had rented. And so I said, Maurice, let me get the car. And so he was like, get the keys from the valet. So we get the keys. And we are going to tour around Monaco. And, you know, it's only like 8 square miles, so not that large, not big at all. And so I just remember my whole goal was, I'm in a sport with speed, right? So I want to get the car. I want to get it up, because it's like six gears. And most of the stick shifts here in the United States, it only goes up to 5 gears. So I was trying my best to get it up to 6 gears, but there's not enough road in Monaco to do that, right?
Yeah.
And then as we're driving around town, like, even though it wasn't that big, like, we kept getting lost. And we just kept driving in circles and circles. And then as we kept driving in circles, the people were laughing at us. Like, they were sitting outside on the sidewalk at the cafes, and they would just crack up laughing every time we came around, because they knew we were lost. But that was like, we were gone for almost 2 hours, probably. And like I said, it's not that large, so there's no reason why we should have been gone that long. But it was the most freeing and the most relaxing thing. And we just laughed, and she and I, we laugh about that all the time. So, but that's one of the memories, one of the moments that I do take away from that. So, yeah.
Kind of your own version of the Monaco Grand Prix, I guess.
Exactly.
An amateur version. Just a couple of more questions.
Exactly.
A couple of more questions for you. The Olympic Games for 2020, of course, were postponed, as were many, many other events throughout the calendar year this year. Mm-hmm. And as of now, it's set for 2021. Did you think about how would that affect you as an athlete? And I'm sure you could sympathize with these athletes who are getting ready to compete in 2020. Training schedules, you're a year older, you have to devote another year to getting ready. What kind of effect does that have on these athletes?
Most definitely, mentally, it affects them mentally. Because you think about some of these kids, they were in the best shape and were running some of their best times. And so to have everything happen, you know, so abruptly, and then just giving, because I'm here working with the track athletes, you know, they were literally at NCAA indoor championships and were told that the meet was canceled. So it's devastating, you know, to think that I'm competing at the highest level I've ever competed at. And, you know, and we had some kids that were, that legitimately had opportunities and chances of probably making the team. And so just the uncertainty of it all, you know, it's hard, and it could be depressing, you know, not to know if and when, you know, the season would resume, if and when the Olympic Games would happen, are they going to take place? And so I think there's probably still, I think some of them probably still question, you know, whether or not that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know that I would be, you know, more than devastated, you know, had that been the case. You think about some of the kids who, some of the athletes who this might have been their last year competing. They may have decided that this is the year I'm retiring. You know, I'm hanging up the spikes. This is it for me. And so for their career to have been ended the way that it ended, you know, when you decide to retire, you want to go out on your terms. And unfortunately, this was completely, you know, out of anyone's hands. So most definitely devastating. And you don't know. Like you said, I mean, you end up taking time off from some training. You don't know what to do in terms of your training, because you don't know when the competition is going to resume.
Let me come back around to your current job again as an academic counselor. You've been at it long enough now that you can point to some success stories among the students that you've worked with, and I'm sure that has to be very, very satisfying. Is there a message that you try to get across to them, in addition to specific academic issues, but a general message that you could try to get across to each of them when you meet with them, and how does that translate then to their academic success?
Well, most definitely, I tell them to treat this as if it is a job, because it is a job. You know, the academic piece, the athletic piece. Also, one of the things that I try to encourage them to do is, because so many of them want to compete after the collegiate eligibility is up, but I also encourage them to continue. What is it that you want to do after your athletic career is over with? Because we all know that at some point in time, that is going to come to an end. And so, and because it's so difficult for so many athletes, and the same with in some other, you know, other jobs, it's difficult because they've identified for so long as a student athlete. Learn who you are outside of being an athlete. I think that is key. I think that is important in making that transition from college to, quote unquote, the real world. So, because, you know, just as an athlete, you know, you live in a bubble to a certain degree. And so learning who they are as a whole person, not just as an athlete, I think being an athlete, that's just one small part of who they are, is one small part of who I was. You know, I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, I'm an academic counselor. I'm many, many different things. I'm not just one thing. And so for me and to them, it's learning who you are as a total person.
Well, congrats.
That is key.
Congratulations on your success as a counselor, and of course, all the great success as an athlete before that. Passion Richardson has been with us. She's a member of the UK Athletics Hall of Fame, Olympic medalist, UK All-American, member of the UK coaching staff, and then now an academic counselor for UK Athletics. Passion, thanks so much for the time. I've enjoyed talking with you, and we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.